And hello again, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thank you again for joining us. Old concrete watchtowers that rise from the marsh grasses near the beaches of the Delaware Shore at Bethany and Dewey, Indian River, and Cape Henlopen serve as reminders, or for the uninitiated, first references to a part of World War II that came perilously close to the mainland United States. It was the German submarine campaign on the eastern seaboard, an attempt by the Nazi regime to control shipping channels and destroy supply lines. Our focus this hour is the year 1942, from January to June of that year, from New York Harbor south to the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay. The German U-boat offensive in that long stretch of the East Coast sank 31 Allied ships and damaged another three, destroying cargo and killing 700 seamen, naval gunners, and civilians in the process. But the attacks in the mid-Atlantic represented just a fraction of the full submarine offensive. Calculations by our guest this hour, military journalist Ed Offley, show that U-boats operating along the East Coast sank a total of 225 ships in 1942. More than 4,600 people aboard those ships were killed. Ed Offley has written a book about the U-boat attacks and the toll they took along the coast from the Jersey Shore to Virginia Beach and North Carolina. And in the process of his research, Ed Offley has uncovered a particularly rich story about an American bomber pilot and the German U-boat commander he hunted. Ed Offley's book is The Burning Shore, How Hitler's U-Boats Brought World War II to America. It's published by Basic Books. And Ed Offley, I want to welcome you to Midday on WYPR. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
If you don't mind, I'd like to start this story on June 15th, 1942, down at Virginia Beach, Virginia, because I think that would give our listeners a good idea about just how close all this came to the shores of the United States. June 15th, 1942, Ed.
Well, the campaign by the U-boats had begun in mid-January, so it had been going on for a number of months, basically from the Canadian coastline to Florida. But on June 15th, a particularly daring operation erupted into view in front of 50,000 vacationers. A German U-boat, U-701, which is one of the focuses of my book, was ordered to lay a minefield across the mouth of the Thimble-Shoal Channel, which is just about where the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel is today. Its captain was 29-year-old Captain Lieutenant Horst Degen, a native of Hamburg. He and his 45 crewmen, instead of just coming across the Atlantic with torpedoes to shoot and sink Allied shipping, were loaded with 15 very powerful magnetic anti-ship mines. And to get the minefield in place correctly, they had to put themselves in grave danger to do so. Germans were very thorough in their military planning, and they timed the mission for the night of the new moon in June of 42, which is the night of the 12th, 13th. Degen had already made one patrol to the Northwest Atlantic back in January, but this was the first time he was in the heart of the battle. They essentially steamed across the open Atlantic, and at the correct time, they came up over the horizon, and they could see the lights of Virginia Beach shining brightly in the evening, and they were astonished. When the U-boats started the campaign back in mid-January, U-boat commanders said they would look at cars driving along the highway at Coney Island, New York, as they prepared to torpedo ships coming out of New York Harbor. Well, here it was 5 months later, and the lights were still on. I had a chance to correspond with Commander Degen years after the war, and he still had awe in his description of the fact that his lookouts were so busy looking into the bedroom windows of the vacation bungalows along the shoreline that he had to keep prodding them to keep paying attention to the mission.
Amazing.
And what they did was very simple. They came directly inshore like they were going to run right up on the beach, and they used the two lighthouses at the mouth of Chesapeake Bay as their own navigation references, and it was a very simple problem. All they had to do was wait until the two lights lined up, and that meant they were right where they were supposed to be. They turned right and came right along the shoreline, only a couple hundred yards offshore, and then very quietly kept moving north until the Cape Henry light was off to their port beam, and they knew they were right where the mines were supposed to go. And it took them about 45 minutes traveling very, very slowly on the surface to drop each mine out at a pre-selected interval. Having done that, they found themselves confronted by a small patrol boat that was going back and forth across the channel. So instead of aborting the mission, he just turned off his loud diesel motors, switched to the electric motors that a U-boat used to travel when submerged, and then just continued to proceed laying the mines. Interesting footnote to that, 30 years ago, I wrote a series of articles in my newspaper in Norfolk about U-701. And the next day, I got a phone call from an old guy who lived out in the country, and he was very angry with me. And he said, "I just want to let you know your story you wrote was completely wrong." I said, "Well, what was wrong about it, sir?" And he said, "Well, I was in that patrol boat, and we never saw a U-boat."
So I'm trying to get this picture here of all these vacationers you describe, some 50,000 people maybe. These huge explosions take place. Two massive fireballs erupt. These were oil tankers headed to the Chesapeake?
They were heading up and down the East Coast. Hampton Roads was a way stop for the convoy.
Mm-hmm.
Other ships going to New York and then across to the British Isles would have left, you know, a day or two later to go on the rest of the way up north. But the Navy had finally, after months of inaction, instituted what they called an interlocking convoy system from the Caribbean and Gulf of Mexico up to the Atlantic ports. And this was a convoy, and it had escorts, but they didn't know that there was a minefield waiting for them, so it took everybody by quite surprise.
Ed Offley is our guest. His book is The Burning Shore, about this campaign. And you focus on 1942. You focus on the Eastern Seaboard in 1942. But, Ed, I was curious, maybe our listeners are wondering, the war had been underway for several years by then, a few years by then. Had the Germans sent over submarines to the East Coast prior to 1942?
No.
No. So this campaign, this drumbeat, that was Operation Drumbeat, actually began in the winter of that year, January.
Right. Adolf Hitler is widely viewed as a lunatic these days. But during 1940 and 41, he desperately wanted to avoid war with the United States. And he imposed a whole bunch of strict rules of engagement that drove his U-boat commanders nuts.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, if there's any doubt it might be an American ship, don't attack. There were several incidents in the spring and summer of 1941 where the U.S. Navy started edging into the battle very slowly to help the British in terms of convoys across the North Atlantic. And, of course, most people remember the Woody Guthrie song, "Who Were Your Friends on the Good Reuben James?" That was one of three U.S. Navy warships that were in combat incidents before Pearl Harbor and before we declared war on Germany. But the declaration of war by Germany against the United States came 4 days after Pearl Harbor. And at that point, Hitler just said, "Okay, go get them." And Admiral Karl Dönitz, who is the head of the German U-boat force, knew that there would be rich pickings off the American East Coast because they had just never seen U-boats there in the first place. And he and his U-boat commanders were absolutely astonished at the lack of defenses they encountered, not just in January, but throughout that whole period.
Yes, because this went on, as you say, for 6 months, January to June. And the numbers I have here from your book, more than 200 merchant vessels sunk, more than 4,600 civilian and military and merchant marine casualties, tons and tons of cargo lost and oil lost during that period. And then finally, I guess, the Navy caught up. The Navy started, having additional patrols?
They finally, in desperation, the Navy officials in charge of the coastal defense established in mid-April a thing they called the Bucket Brigade, which is a very ad hoc series of protected anchorages along the coast. And they would, you know, groups of ships would rush from one anchorage to the next and hide there overnight with a few escort ships and then proceed the next day. This started to complicate the task of the U-boat commanders to attack and sink, but it didn't stop it altogether. Finally, it was actually in mid-May, right around the time U-701 was getting ready to sail over to drop the minefield, that the Navy finally rounded up enough destroyers and Coast Guard cutters and other ships that could escort a regular convoy system. And all of a sudden, it was obvious it was not the easy time anymore for the U-boats. It was becoming very difficult. But throughout this horrible 6.5 month period, both the Navy and the Army Air Forces were caught totally unprepared to deal with U-boats, which to me is an astonishing lapse of military preparedness. The admirals themselves admitted, I've got the reports, that based on experience in World War I, they were expecting the U-boats to come inshore, because that's what they did in the summer of 1918. A group of just five U-boats sank about 4 or 5 dozen ships in a six-month period. Plus, they'd been watching the Battle of the Atlantic around the British Isles and in the Mediterranean and across the great convoy routes, and they knew the U-boats were not only out there, but they were getting bigger and stronger by the day. So when the war suddenly was in place between Germany and the United States, you know, one might expect they'd do something to be prepared, and there was a total lack of preparedness. It's, to me, unimaginable.
By the way, Ed, I mentioned Operation Drumbeat. That was the name of this campaign on the East Coast?
Technically, it was the first wave of U-boats in January. There were a group of... Here's another example of how things weren't as smooth and clean as you might think. Carl Dönitz thought with 20 U-boats, he could completely destroy the entire East Coast shipping in one blow. So he went to his boss, Admiral Raeder, the head of the German Navy, and said, "I want 20 U-boats." Well, Adolf Hitler said, "You can have six." And so all he had was six U-boats at the beginning. In fact, one of them broke down and had to limp back to port. So the massacre started out with just a very small number of U-boats, but he kept surging more and more. So it became like a steady flow of, you know, fully armed and fully loaded U-boats coming across as the other ones finished their patrols and returned to France.
Ed Offley is our guest in this hour of Midday on WYPR, the author now of The Burning Shore, How Hitler's U-Boats Brought World War II to America. When we get back, we'll talk to Ed some more about the East Coast campaign of the German submarines, how they approached the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay, and more about Lieutenant Harry Kane of the U.S. Air Forces, the pilot who's featured in his book, and Lieutenant Commander Horst Degen, the German U-boat commander. More about that story when we get back. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. My guest, Ed Offley, is a military journalist and been writing about military affairs for quite a while. His latest book is The Burning Shore, How Hitler's U-Boats Brought World War II to America. And Ed, you know, I asked you earlier whether there had been any attacks on merchant vessels, any vessels, by submarines before January of 42. You answered that for me. Thank you. But I asked because the towers that I referred to, these concrete watchtowers that you can find along the southern Jersey shore and the Delaware shore, I guess there's about 11 of them still standing.
I've seen the one at Cape Henlopen. Yeah, they were one of many just desperation moves that the Allies tried to make to do something to stop the U-boats.
Well, because I read that some of them went up earlier than 1942, that some were in place in 1940 and 41. So I guess there must have been some concern about the war approaching.
Well, I'm glad somebody was worried about it. Unfortunately, in my reading of all of the histories of the Battle of the Atlantic, I unfortunately cannot come across any example where those towers actually were able to triangulate the location of a U-boat and lead to its destruction. And one of the reasons was, at the beginning of 1942, we talked about the Navy not being prepared. The U.S. Army Air Forces was in a massive expansion program all across the country. It would double in size twice in the year 1942 alone. But they were still very much not ready for combat, and worse, they were totally unprepared to try and locate and attack U-boats. They didn't have radar at the time. They didn't have the training. They didn't have depth charges. What they tended to do is they'd see a U.S. Navy destroyer steaming along, and they'd immediately think it was a U-boat, and they'd try to drop bombs on it. But fortunately, their bombardiers were as ill-trained as their ship recognition people. So it was pretty pathetic.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit later in the hour about Lieutenant Harry Kane, who is at the time a 22-year-old U.S. Army Air Forces pilot that you highlight in the book, and his relationship with the man you've already referenced, Lieutenant Commander Horst Degen, who is the commander of U-701. Now, U-701 was one of how many U-boats that took part in this operation for the Germans?
The total U-boat force in the war itself numbered about 830. I don't have the exact number in front of me, but it was like three or four dozen at most took part during the six-month period.
Okay.
In fact, both U-701 and another famous U-boat, U-123, were in the first wave of the campaign in mid-January, finished up by the end of the month, and were back toward the end of that cycle for their second patrol in American waters. So I'd say it was about three or four dozen. Some of the patrol routes were a little convoluted. Some went up to Canada. The Gulf of St. Lawrence became a target. And, of course, in February of 42, Doines opened an entirely different and separate campaign in the Caribbean and Gulf of Mexico. And some of his longer-range boats took part both along the East Coast and then would head down south, where the oil tankers were loading up near Trinidad.
A question about that, if you don't mind, Ed, from one of our listeners, Otis, who wrote us an email, very curious about how these U-boats made the crossing of the Atlantic. Where did they fuel up to make it to the United States?
They fueled up in their home port zone, occupied France, and they used very economical cruising to cross the ocean. When Horst Degen took U-701 across, he had two things he could do. He had to travel from one French port, Saint-Nazaire, or actually Brest, up to Lorient to actually have the mines loaded on board. And he got a full fuel load in Brest. And then when he got to Lorient, he fibbed and told the port authorities that he hadn't had time to fill up. And he got another 10 or 15 tons of fuel. God knows where he put it, in water tanks or something. And that was gave him a couple of extra days cruising ability. Once he got to the East Coast. But what they would do is they would just shut down to one engine and go very slowly on the mid-Atlantic crossing to save fuel and prolong their patrol.
Now, did the U-boats utilize, you talked about the utilization of mines, the setting of mines, the dropping of mines, not the dropping, or the setting of mines by U-701. Did most of the U-boats do that, or they also use torpedoes, I assume?
No, this was a kind of an exceptional mission. In fact, for the mining program, there were actually two other U-boats were loaded as well. One went to the mouth of Delaware Bay and dropped a minefield, and the third was supposed to mine the harbor approaches to New York, but Doines found out there was a Portuguese-flagged neutral ship getting ready to sail to Europe with a bunch of German diplomats who had been interned after Pearl Harbor. And so he didn't want to sink that ship, so he ordered that captain to go up to Boston. Well, the Delaware Bay mining was very unsuccessful. It only sank one vessel, and that was just like a 300-ton tugboat came across the mine. And the fellow that mined Boston Harbor completely missed the channel altogether, and nothing ever happened.
So most of the attacks were carried out with torpedoes?
Torpedoes, and they also had a very accurate deck cannon. One of the things that I found interesting, of the 31 ships that were sunk during this coastal campaign, I believe two of them were actually sunk by deck gunfire. To save torpedoes, if the ship was, you know, pretty isolated and undefended, the U-boat could surface, fire a couple of warning shots with its cannon to make them stop, mm-hmm. let the crew get into lifeboats, and they just shell the ship with their gun until it sank.
I go back to June 15th, 1942, Virginia Beach, and these massive explosions that occur off the beach as people are on vacation, enjoying the beach there. This was the work of U-701 with Lieutenant Commander Degen at the helm. Did the Navy react that day? Was there any chase put on? What happened?
they went nuts. One of the ironies, and I don't want to prolong this too much, is that the Navy did have an intelligence warning that the Germans were planning to drop mines And the letter went out warning all the port units to look out for mines. Went out the day that the mines started exploding. So it was a little bit late.
A little too late for that.
There was an immediate response by patrol planes and escorts in that convoy. And what they were doing was churning up the mud, chasing phantom sonar contacts, and generally making a nuisance of themselves. Horst Degen had dropped the mines by 1:30 in the morning on June 13th, and then he and his crew got the hell out of there. And by the time the mine timers activated, he was already down off Cape Hatteras looking for ships to shoot with torpedoes. But the you know, they say that the first a newspaper article is the first rough draft of history. My old newspaper, the Virginian Pilot, had eyewitness accounts where three people saw the submarine being attacked by the airplanes, and of course, they were just imagining it.
Now, Horst Degen, let's talk about him. He was 27 years old at the time, commander of U-701. He was on a pretty good roll, wasn't he? He was having some success beyond these oil tankers.
Well, he was very highly regarded by Admiral Doynitz, who took a personal interest in all of his U-boat commanders. His first patrol had been rather unfortunate because it left Germany in late December 41 and had to travel all the way to Newfoundland. And for like 9 out of 10 days, they were sailing into the teeth of a southwest gale or hurricane force storm. So, and because of the turbulence in the water, he made several torpedo attacks on ships that he encountered. But because of the rough water, all of the shots missed. And he was very frustrated by that. But he had one experience where he was up in the conning tower, and there's an Allied merchant freighter about 1,000 yards away, and he got the settings and ordered the torpedoes fired a spread of two torpedoes. And he was, you know, looking at a stopwatch, and, you know, after 30 seconds, he realized it probably had missed. But suddenly, he heard cheering down below in his U-boat. And what had happened was his crewman, just inside the steel hull, had heard the twin booms of the two torpedoes striking the British freighter, but unfortunately the warheads failed. So it was not always, you know, six for six.
Right.
He and his crew did sink one freighter during that first patrol, and then during the second attempt to sink Allied ships, he and about another two dozen U-boats were, again, Adolf Hitler put his thumb on the dike and sent a whole bunch of U-boats up towards Iceland because in his imagination, he thought the Allies were about to invade Norway. And he ordered his Navy to do it, and they did what they were told. And so he spent a very fruitless 30 days on patrol off of Iceland and only managed to sink four or five small patrol vessels. But he was entrusted with this very critical mission and was the only U-boat commander to really be successful at it.
Well, take us now, Ed Ed Offley, take us now to the North Carolina coast, July 1942, and we're still with U-701 and Lieutenant Commander Degen. What happens there off the Carolina coast?
Well, it was physically incredibly punishing for U-boats at that time of year. By July, the water temperature off the Cape is usually in the 70s or even 80s, which it doesn't sound so bad, but the U-boats, as they were designed, created intense heat inside the hull, and they relied upon the cooler water outside to help equalize the temperature. If the temperature of the water outside was 70 or 80 degrees, things like the electric batteries, the electronics equipment inside the U-boat would force the temperature up until it was over 120 degrees Fahrenheit. And because of the now increased air patrols over the coastal waters, the U-boats were forced to remain submerged during daylight hours because the water was too shallow to dive in their hunting areas. So they would go off the coast where the depth fell off, and they would literally hide there for like 17 or 18 hours at a time. And it was to read about it, it almost makes you nauseous. The air was so foul they could hardly breathe. The heat was overpowering. The stress of waiting for the chance to go in and attack was another factor. And by the time They'd been down there for a couple of weeks. The poor crew was pretty beat up. They did have several successes and several failures while they were there. During their initial patrol, they came across this little Navy YP patrol boat that was essentially tasked with just going up and down just offshore of the Outer Banks of North Carolina. And it kept getting in Deggan's way, and so he snuck up on it one night, surfaced, and his deck gun crew blew the boat out of the water. It was totally, again, an inadequate defense. The little YP boat had one gun that didn't work. At its fastest speed, it could not even catch up with the U-boat, and it had no ability to maneuver effectively when attacked. So the poor devils on that YP boat, about half of whom were killed or injured, were just sitting ducks for the U-701. But then later on, they were able to sink a very large oil tanker, the SS William Rockefeller, and damage two other ships. But by that time, the defenses had become pretty severe, and Deggan knew that the easy times along North Carolina were coming to an end.
And then we look up in the sky, and here's Harry Kane. This is where Harry Kane comes into the story. Second Lieutenant Harry Kane.
Yeah, let me tell you about Harry Kane. I found him a fascinating guy. I had the very good luck of meeting him when he was in retirement in the early 1980s. He was from Brooklyn, New York, Irish Catholic fellow. He was like many people of his generation. He knew that Roosevelt was saying the United States didn't want to enter the war. And he also realized that sometimes the war joins you whether you want it or not. And so he decided, his family had some money, he decided to go ahead and take flying lessons even before he volunteered for the military. And so he was very well prepared to become an Army Air Force's pilot. And he joined up in the spring of 41 and was commissioned and sent to an operational squadron about 4 days after Pearl Harbor. His experience in the first part of this period was one of frustration, because his unit was out on the West Coast flying patrols to forestall a second Japanese attack, even though everybody knew the Japanese were long gone. But finally, in right around the time Deggan was laying his minefield, Harry Kane's squadron was redeployed to a place called Cherry Point, North Carolina, which today is still a very large Marine Corps air station. At that time, it was three runways and a construction site. There were only a few hundred people there. It was still just very, very much being built. Excuse me. So anyway, his squadron had 13 of these twin-engine A-29 Hudson bombers. For your listeners who don't know that much about that kind of aircraft, it's pretty much from the outside looks like Amelia Earhart's Lockheed Electra that she used to try and fly around the world. Twin engine, twin tails. It was considered a light bomber, had a crew of five people. And their patrol patterns were very simple. Two planes would take off in the pre-dawn, and then two more planes would take off at midday, and then two more planes in mid-afternoon. And they would fly out about 25 miles off the coast, then split up. One plane would fly up towards Norfolk, while the second plane flew south along the coast to just about Charleston.
Ed Offley, hold cut. Ed, I want you to hold on, okay? We're gonna take a break here so you can get a drink of water or something. I don't want to break up this story about how Harry Kane comes to meet Lieutenant Commander Horst Deggan. So we'll take a break here and we'll come back. You take a refresher drink, and we'll continue our story in just a moment. We're speaking with Ed Offley here on WYPR today, the Midday Show. Ed Offley's book is The Burning Shore. This is a book about the Nazi U-boat campaign that took place between January and June 1942 along the east coast of the United States, came right along the Delaware shore, the Maryland shore, down to Virginia, the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay, down into North Carolina, where we'll pick up that story in just a moment. And welcome back to Midday. January to June 1942, 21 German U-boats operating along the East Coast sank 226 merchant freighters and oil tankers. More than 4,600 merchant sailors, naval gunners, and civilian passengers were killed during this campaign. We're speaking with Ed Offley, who's chronicled this story in a book called The Burning Shore, How Hitler's U-Boats Brought World War II to America. Basic Books is the publisher. Now, where we left off in the storytelling, Ed, we had the commander of the German U-boat 701, U-701, Horst Degen, off the coast of North Carolina. It's July 1942. It's about two or three weeks after he's managed to sink a couple of big oil tankers off of Virginia Beach while vacationers are watching. And up in the sky is Second Lieutenant Harry Kane and his squadron out on patrol looking for German U-boats. And it's July 7th, 1942, and they spot U-701. I'll let you pick up the story there.
One of the things you have to know is that we are now about 6 months into the campaign, and only four U-boats have been sunk so far, two by ships and two by aircraft off Newfoundland. They were very elusive. They were very hard to find. They could submerge in less than 30 seconds. So if an airplane saw them from afar and their U-boat lookouts saw the plane, the U-boats normally won that race. And what happened, the reason Harry Kane succeeded this time around, and by the way, became the first Army pilot ever to sink a U-boat, ever, U.S. Army, is that he violated the rules. For some idiotic reason, I've never been able to find out. The doctrine was you're supposed to fly at 500 feet off the water, where you can maybe see, you know, 5 or 6 miles in any direction. Well, on this day, they're flying back from South Carolina on their home leg of their patrol, and Kane looked up and saw a cloud layer at about 1,200 feet above the water, and he thought to himself, hey, I can hide up there. And so he pulled the airplane up into the clouds, and every 30 seconds or so, he'd kind of poke down, take a look, poke back up again. And after about an hour and a half of this, he suddenly noticed a very thin line on the water about 10 miles away to the west, just a very little straight line. And he you know, alerted his air crew. They all looked, and they all agreed it was either a boat or a submarine. So they turned toward the U-boat and started sneaking up on it in the cloud layer. Well, what had happened was, once again, it had been a thoroughly miserable, hot 17 hours for the crew of U-701. Degen decided that he was going to break the rules. Instead of refreshing the air at night, he decided to pop up for just about 5 or 10 minutes. And essentially, by adjusting and manipulating the air intakes, he could just suck fresh air into the submarine by starting its diesel engines. And so they were in the middle of doing that when Harry Kane and his crew spotted them about 12 miles away. Well, what happened was one of the lookouts on the U-boat was daydreaming, and he wasn't paying attention. And just as Degen said, okay, we're done, let's, you know, take her down, suddenly the guy screamed and said, airplane dead aft. They looked up, and here comes this A-29 flying at him less than a mile away. Well, this time the U-boat lost the race. Kane straddled it with two of the three depth charges he was carrying. The U-boat was totally submerged when one of the depth charges ripped a hole in the pressure hull. I have eyewitness accounts from the seven survivors of what that was like. Well, the German U-boat guys hit the bottom of the seabed. It was only 100 feet deep. If it had been deeper, 200-300 feet, nobody would have survived. But because they were in such shallow water, all but about 5 or 6 of the 46-man crewmen got out safely. They were trained to you know, ascend in the water and not, you know, rise too fast.
And Ed, what happened? Ed, this is considered the first successful sinking of a U-boat in American waters.
By an Army Air Force's plane.
By an Army Air Force plane.
Right. The U.S. Navy had two kills off Newfoundland up by Canada. Mm-hmm. And in two separate instances, U-boats have been sunk by surface ships. But this is the first time the Army had been able to do that. Well, anyway, they were popping up to the surface. Meanwhile, Kane threw his airplane in a very tight circle at just about 100 feet off the water because he was afraid that maybe they hadn't sunk the boat and it was trying to trick them by, you know, jettisoning oil and, you know, debris and stuff. They did that a lot to make the attacker feel like they you know, had sunk when they in fact had not. Well, all of a sudden, Kane and his men saw these, you know, small figures popping to the surface, and most of them had no flotation gear. They were treading water, essentially. And he did a very kind thing. He ordered his crewmen to take off their own life jackets and throw them out of the plane to the fellows down below. Well, events moved very quickly. Kane tried without success to radio other aircraft and ships to come and pick these guys up. There was just some interference in the radio. And finally, he had to leave because he was running out of gas. He made it back to Cherry Point. They organized a search. The next day, everybody went out looking. But the poor Germans had come up in the middle of the Gulf Stream, and they were steadily drifting about 5 miles an hour to the northeast. By the time they were finally found in the afternoon of July 9th, which is about 49 hours later, there were only 7 of them still alive. The rest had drowned. And one of them, who was wearing the life jacket of the bombardier of Harry Kane's aircraft, was Horst Degen. Hmm. So they were rushed to Norfolk, suffering incredible dehydration, exposure, oil, you know, in their lungs, and all survived. Well, Harry Kane, you know, was just doing his regular duty. He'd filed his report and thought, well, that's it. And he was suddenly ordered to appear at his squadron office, and he and his air crew were flown up to Norfolk, and they were taken to this hospital ward with machine gun toting FBI agents in the hallway. And he was ushered in, and he saw this very emaciated, sunburned, very ill-looking, skinny young man sitting in a chair with a bathrobe on. And this one guy walks up to the man and muttered something to him in German. And Harry came, or Horst Degen, painfully rose to his feet and in perfect English saluted Harry Kane and said, "Congratulations, good attack."
He congratulated him on sinking his U-701.
Yes. Yeah. And one of the things that I find particularly poignant was they went on with their war. I mean, the 7 survivors went on to be POWs, and that guaranteed their survival. Of half the surviving survivors from the U-boat force, which was slaughtered later in the war, of 10,000 survivors, half of them survived because they were already taken POW. Your life expectancy as a German U-boat man was not very good after 1943. Hmm. Well, anyway, Harry Kane went back to the West Coast. His squadron redeployed at the end of that summer. He ended up in the Aleutian Islands for a couple of years and then ended his war as a flight instructor out in the Midwest. And Degen got repatriated back to Germany in 1946. But it wasn't until the 1980s that they both started wondering what had ever happened to the other. And they were able to find each other through corresponding with German newspapers. And in 1982, Harry Kane and his wife traveled to Germany and met Horst Degen and his family. And I always found this particularly poignant. In the immediate aftermath of the loss of his U-boat, Degen's response to Kane had been, "Good attack." But when Harry Kane and his wife knocked on Horst Degen's door in the summer of 1982, what Horst Degen said was, "Thank you, Harry, for saving my life."
Because Harry's plane had tossed them life jackets.
And yeah, his perspective had changed.
Yeah. Right. That's amazing. Ed Offley, I'm curious, how did you discover this particular part of the story, the Kane-Degen connection?
I found it because I learned, this took a couple of years, but I learned that the U-boat guy had survived, that 7 of the crewmen had survived, including the commander. And through the help of a German naval historian named Jürgen Rover, very famous in this naval history circles, I was able to track down Horst Degen, and we exchanged letters. I don't know if you remember letters where you typed it out on paper and put a stamp on the envelope.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a couple of decades before email.
Right.
And we actually corresponded for a year. And then right around that time is when he and Harry Kane came together, and it turned out Harry Kane lived just down the road an hour or two from where I was in Norfolk, Virginia. So I drove down and had a really nice interview with him.
Okay. I wanted to go over some things about the campaign. I mean, this is a great story that you have there with Degen and Kane. But just to back up a little bit, most of the the attacks were on merchant vessels. Did any of the U-boats during this campaign in 42 sink naval vessels other than...
Oh, they'd go after naval vessels in a heartbeat. In the Mid-Atlantic campaign that we focused on here today, two warships were sunk during that period. The destroyer Jacob Jones was an old World War I four-stack destroyer, and he was patrolling off Delaware sometime, I believe, in March. And he came upon a freighter that had just been torpedoed and was circling around it, trying to see if he could help find survivors, when the same U-boat blew him out of the water. And in fact, one of the things that you notice very early on is that warships could sink U-boats, but they were much more vulnerable to torpedoes because they were so small and thin-skinned. And the second warship that went to the bottom was a British trawler that struck one of Horstegan's mines, the Kingston Salonite. It was the third of the four ships that went up in that minefield. But yeah, they would go after warships. In fact, sometimes they gave that a priority because once you get rid of the escorts, then the convoy or the other ships are just, you know, free picking.
Right. And I'm curious about this, Ed. When you maybe go out to speak with your book or just to talk to people about what you're working on, this particular story, do most people think that the whole thing about German U-boats along the shores of the United States in World War II was apocryphal, that it actually was just, you know, myths perpetuated by people? Do most people believe that this occurred, or are they having an awareness of it?
No, it's actually everything else. Either it's people who are actually old enough to still remember this, who go, oh my God, it's been a long time since I heard about this. But most of the younger generations, including my own, and I'm 66, go, oh my God, I never knew that happened.
Right.
I mean, there have been naval histories written, but it remained in the popular mind. I've been interviewed by very experienced journalists who freely confess they'd never heard of this. And so that cheers, as a writer, that really cheers me up.
Yeah, it's great. Good for you. Yeah.
It's a story that needs retelling, and I'm glad to be able to get a chance to do that.
And as I mentioned, folks from Maryland go to the Delaware shore. Of course, they go to the Maryland shore, but on the Delaware shore, there are still those concrete watchtowers, and I'm not sure everybody understands why they're there. And the one at Cape Henlopen is the only one that Cape Henlopen is the only one that's actually open for visitors. The other thing I wanted to say to you was, you were describing earlier the conditions aboard these U-boats. And it wasn't until I went aboard the USS Torsk, which is docked at the Baltimore Maritime Museum. It's in the Baltimore Inner Harbor. It's a Tench class submarine from World War II. It was in the Pacific. It actually, I think, the Torsk torpedoed a ship, August 45, the last enemy ship sunk by the U.S. Navy in World War II, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, until I went onto the Torsk inside that thing, I had no perspective. I had no idea, just from watching movies about World War II submarines, and how tight it was in there. And when you describe being in the German U-boat down for 17, 18 hours in these conditions, 120 degrees inside this thing, it's just amazing that men did this.
Well, they talked about the ceremony of the fourth week. I don't know if I mentioned that in my notes or not, but there's no storage space for any private belongings. So a sailor would go aboard to go on a patrol with the uniform he was wearing, and he would continue to wear that. And at the end of 4 weeks, they'd have a ceremony where they'd take it off and turn it inside out and put it back on again.
And he'd continue to wear it because there was no place to...
No.
Laundry. He would be naked if he did it. Put it in the laundry, I guess, right?
Yeah, maybe it would have been better off. I don't know.
But, I mean, until you get into one of these submarines, I don't know if folks have the opportunity to do this. That's why it's great that we have the Torsk here in Baltimore. You can't appreciate what that was really like. I think maybe the film Das Boot was able to convey that.
Well, we have what I call the Colonial Williamsburg Dilemma. If they made it too realistic, nobody would want to go.
Right. This campaign kind of ended. When did it end? When was the last time German U-boats were along the East Coast?
About a week after U-701 went down, a second U-boat called U-576 attacked a convoy just about the same area, and it was sunk by both gunfire from one of the freighters and some patrol planes. Unfortunately for that boat, where he went down, it was like 2,000 or 3,000 feet of water, so everybody just perished. And when Admiral Dönitz learned, he had gotten some gloomy reports from both Degen and some of the other U-boat guys that the shipping was just not showing up, and if it did show up, it was heavily armed convoys. And when he lost two boats in a week or so, he realized that it was time to move on. And what he did was he redirected the U-boat force to a new area of operations. And one thing I just want to put in perspective is that this wasn't the end of a campaign. The U-boat force was, like the U.S. Army and U.S. Navy, was still growing and growing and growing, even in the summer of 42. And it was setting the stage for the next two phases of the Battle of the Atlantic, which was the fall convoy battles up between Iceland and Newfoundland and Britain. And then after the winter storms of 42, the crisis of the Atlantic happened in 1943, and that's what I wrote about in my earlier book, Turning the Tide. So there were phases and phases, but the Germans did not lose for almost another year. They were still very much in the hunt.
And as far as the U.S.'s submarine force, did we get up to speed pretty quickly?
They had an interesting thing. Admiral Ernie King took over as the Navy's chief right after Pearl Harbor, mm-hmm. and they had, I believe, two squadrons of American submarines up in New England to theoretically help out with convoy escorts. But what they found out was the submarines kept getting attacked by the Allies because they thought they were U-boats. So he essentially, except for a handful of boats, sent all of his submarines to the Pacific, where they did the same campaign against Japanese shipping. But the war in the Atlantic really was an airplane and surface ship war.
Ed, it was good to get you on the show, and thank you for the book on this overlooked aspect of World War II history, The Burning
Shore.
Thank you.
Can I give you my website?
Sure. Go right ahead, quickly.
People want information. It's the title, www.theburningshore.com.
TheBurningShore.com. The Burning Shore is the name of Ed Offley's book, How Hitler's U-Boats Brought World War II to America. Basic Books is the publisher. Ed, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Dan Rodericks here. That's our midday for today. Have a great afternoon. We'll see you again soon.
Midday senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are James Daly, Tom Cartaxo, and Michelle Richardson. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at wypr.org. Dan Rodrick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.